there was exhausting and excruciating. For the next 2.5 minutes, tense and tired offense met resolute defense. 9 shots went up between the two teams, and 9 shots went awry. LeBron missed 3 times, falling into the isolation that is a signature of high-pressure moments. But Curry missed 2, as did Thompson, Green, and Iguodala. There were no timeouts called. Back and forth they went, the building tensing each time a shot went into the air. In Cleveland, more than 15,000 were watching inside Quicken Loans Arena, squeezing into seats around the construction of the stage for the Republican National Convention. Outside, thousands more watched on giant screens, craning out of parking decks and herding around televisions at bars across downtown. Each shot met tension and release as it missed. The 9th miss came on a floater by Irving, with 2 minutes left and the scoreboard still locked at 89-89. He'd gotten a matchup with Curry and tried to exploit it, but his touch was off. Iguodala came out with the ball and tore off to the other end, trying to manufacture a scoring chance with speed. It was a smart play. The Cavs were sluggish, and it quickly turned into a 2-on-1 fast break, with Iguodala speeding down the floor along with Curry and only Smith back for the Cavs. No one running the floor or watching it unfold could have known this, but what was about to happen would end up becoming a signature moment. A play standing still on its own from the mess that came before it, frozen in time as one of the single most dominant defensive plays in league history by one of the league's single most dominant players forevermore. Iguodala picked up his dribble and tossed a chest pass ahead to Curry, who caught the pass and immediately fed it right back to him, bouncing the ball off the floor as he followed the fundamentals of executing a fast break. Iguodala caught it in stride on his way to the hoop. At this point, Smith was scrambling to defend both players, and committing a foul wouldn't have been the worst decision. Because of the pass, Iguodala had an angle on him. What Smith didn't see was James in a dead sprint to get back into the play. One of the fastest ever to play because of his long strides, James made up ground, but was still 3 or 4 feet behind as Iguodala took to the air with the ball in his right hand. Smith stuck his hand straight up, not fouling, and Iguodala adjusted, moving around him to get a clear shot. It was clear, and then it wasn't. James came steaming into the lane, zooming past Curry with his eyes wide in a mix of determination and desperation. He flung both hands into the air, not knowing what the crafty Iguodala was going to do, which side of the basket he was going to go to. But Smith, in addition to slowing Iguodala slightly, shielded the approaching James from Iguodala's view, and he never saw it coming. It happened so fast that people in the arena couldn't even clearly see what took place. James pinned Iguodala's shot against the backboard. It went from a sure hoop and a Warriors lead on their home floor to nothing. James had executed chase-down blocks dozens of times over the years, but nothing like this. It may have instantly become the single greatest play of his career. It combined all his talents, his speed, his size, his athleticism, his competitiveness, his intelligence, to size up the angles and close the distance. "I would definitely rank it number one," James told Business Insider later that summer. "Just because of the magnitude of the game, what was going on at that point in the game, and I had to run through a couple of guys and get around a couple of guys to get to that position. You know, it was a big moment, not only for that particular moment in the game, but for Cleveland sports history. Now that you kind of look back on it, a lot of people are saying that. For me, I think a lot of people will base a game-winning jump shot or a dunk or something that happened offensively as their most memorable play. For a staple play for my legacy to be a block, something defensively to help us win, that's the ultimate for me. It would become known as the block." By that point in the game, James already had registered a triple-double, joining Jerry West and James Worthy as just the 3rd player in league history with a triple-double in Game 7 of the Finals, He was, as Lou implored him to be at halftime, much better. As significant as it felt in the moment, it was still a tied game. The block had perhaps saved the game, but it didn't win it. Both teams missed again, including Curry, who was unable to summon the magic he had all season, as he badly missed a three, shooting it so far right that it hit nothing but backboard. Lou called a timeout with 1:09 left, the teams now having missed 12 straight shots. As Lou huddled with his coaches to ponder the play call, James sat on the bench with Irving standing alongside him. Smith sat next to James, cursing about the previous few plays. James tried to look around Irving to catch Lou's eye. As Lou walked to the huddle holding his clipboard, James pointed at Irving. As great as James had been all series and all game, he and Lou agreed to set up a play for Irving to have the ball. Lou designed a play that would isolate Irving on Curry. Lou figured with the rhythm Irving showed in the second half, combined with the beating Curry had taken all series long, the Cavs point guard would have a quickness advantage matched up against the two-time MVP and would be able to get by him on his way to the basket, where he'd either have a layup or the chance to draw a foul. Lou made a sub, putting Richard Jefferson in for Tristan Thompson. It took the best rebounder off the floor, but would force the Warriors to guard Jefferson outside the paint, the idea being to open driving space for Irving. Lou called for the Cavs to run horns, a favorite play of his old coach Phil Jackson. Only the ball wasn't going to Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant. It was going to Kyrie Irving. "He wants to come out every night and destroy his opponent," Lou later explained. "We knew and he knew we had confidence in him to take that shot. I thought he was going to go to the basket. We had the matchup we wanted, but he took a three-point shot. But he's been making that shot his whole career." Horns did its job. A pick set by Smith forced a switch of defenders and moved the bigger Klay Thompson off Irving and got Curry on him. As soon as Irving got Curry on him, he dribbled backwards a few steps toward the Oracle Arena logo at center court, putting the two on an island. Curry backpedaled as Irving slowly approached the three-point line. Irving dribbled through his legs to his right, then through his legs to his left, then back through to his right. He was probing Curry. While dribbling the ball with his right hand, he executed a hesitation dribble to his right. It surprised Curry for a split second. Typically, when right-handed players go into a shot, they cross the ball over from their left hand to their right to get it in shooting position. But Irving hopped right and immediately went up with the ball in his right hand. It was awkward, but the kind of thing Irving practiced all the time. One of his little tricks to open space. It wasn't much, an extra foot or two, but it freed him up to launch a clean shot from deep on the right side, beyond the three-point line. Curry raised an arm to contest, but Irving, near the spot on the court where he fractured his kneecap in overtime of Game 1 of the Finals a year before, faded away to create the shooting angle. James stood in the corner as the shot went up, contorting his body along with the path of the ball, as it made its way toward the rim, trying to will it in. It fell through the net. Finally, the ice broke, and it put the Cavs up by 3, 92-89, leaving only 53 seconds on the clock between Cleveland and an end to a 52-year championship curse. It became known as the shot. Feeling pressure, the Warriors designed a similar play for their star guard, Curry. Just like the Cavs did on their previous possession, the Warriors ran a high pick and roll between Curry and Green, hoping Cleveland would switch, and they did. Irving switched onto Green, leaving Love matched up one-on-one against Curry a few feet beyond the three-point arc. Numerous times over the previous two seasons, Love had been benched late in games because of his defensive issues. He often struggled covering his own man, much less one of the most elusive players in the league. It was thought with this exact weakness that he could be attacked as the weak defensive link, he wouldn't even be on the floor at the end of games against the Warriors. Yet here he was, on Curry, with a championship on the line. Curry started looking for an opening for a three-pointer to tie the game. The 6'10" Love shuffled his feet, beating the 6'3" Curry to the spot as he was dribbling toward and forcing Curry to cross the ball over and head back to his right. Love's momentum was taking him out of the play, but he quickly steadied himself and recovered and was able to get Curry back in front of him. Curry passed it to Green on the right wing to reset, and Green tossed it right back to Curry, now some 40 feet from the basket. Love looked to see if he could switch back to defend Green, but no, he was out by himself to manage Curry. For most players, the thought of pulling up from that far away from the basket with the game on the line would be absurd. But Curry isn't most players. He made virtually the same shot to beat Oklahoma City at the buzzer during the regular season. So Curry pump-faked, and Love, thinking the Warriors superstar could very well shoot it from that deep, jumped off his feet. With Love off balance, Curry dribbled to his left and then crossed it over back quickly to his right. Love scrambled, his feet moving faster than any of his teammates had ever seen. He kept his eyes locked on Curry's, trying to keep up. After nearly 14 long seconds with Love on him, Curry finally launched a three-pointer. Love was in position, and he reached up his arm, blocking Curry's vision. Curry could have made the shot. One of the greatest shooters of all time with unmatched confidence, he could have made the shot in the dark. But Love made it tough, and the pressure made it tougher, and the shot missed off the rim with 30.7 seconds left, James zipping in to grab the rebound. The Cavs had the ball, and thanks to Love's work, they still had the lead. The championship was in sight. It became known as the Stop. James, Irving, and Love, the trio who'd come together and stayed together to try to reach this moment. All the meetings, the social media, the injuries, the coaching battles, the controversies, the doubts. They were there together, and each of them had delivered their own championship moment. Irving rushed up the floor to try to get an easy basket to seal it, but the Warriors recovered, Iguodala blocking him at the rim. The ball was slapped right back at Irving as he was careening out of bounds, but he was able to save it without stepping on the baseline and lobbed it back out to a trailing Love beyond the three-point line with 22.4 seconds left. The Warriors had a foul to give and used it to stop the clock. James inbounded the ball back to Irving, who again drove straight for the hoop, only this time found James with a perfect pass as he exploded into the lane. James leapt off the floor after receiving the pass, aiming to power dunk the ball in what probably would have been dubbed the dunk had it been allowed to happen. With no choice, Green met him in the air and fouled him hard and clean, but it caused James to miss and tumble to the court, bracing his fall with his right wrist and elbow with 10.6 seconds left. In 2002, when James was 17, he broke his left wrist on a play similar to it, as he was undercut on a dunk. In 2010, he developed an issue with his right elbow, and for years since, he'd worn a sleeve to help protect it. James was awarded 2 free throws, but as he writhed on the ground in pain, clutching his right wrist, the one that controls his shooting hand, a doomsday scenario started to play out in the minds of the downtrodden Cleveland fan base once again. James slammed his left fist on the court in both frustration and pain. What if he couldn't shoot the free throws? Cleveland called its last time out as members of the medical staff, head trainer Steve Spiro and James's personal trainer Mike Mancius among them, rushed all the way down the floor from the Cavs bench to attend to James on the opposite baseline. James was able to stay in the game after the timeout and made his way to the free throw line, still wincing in pain as he held his wrist in his left hand and rotated it. He shot the first free throw and missed it. Nothing but the back of the rim. Another miss and the Warriors could get the rebound with 2 timeouts remaining and a chance to tie. He stepped off the line, pulled up his jersey to wipe the sweat off his face, adjusted his arm sleeve, wiped the sweat off his hands onto the back of his shorts, and went back to receive the ball from the referee. The crowd hissed, trying to will another miss. This time he made it, rattling it in. The Warriors called timeout, down 93-89, with 10.6 seconds left. James momentarily put both fists in the air, just as he did ever so briefly after Irving's made three less than a minute earlier, before bringing them down and simply holding up the index finger on his right hand. "One stop," James said. "One stop. One fucking stop. One fucking stop." Lou took over the huddle. All series long, as it played out over the course of nearly 3 weeks, Lou used whatever practice, shoot-around, and walk-through time the team had to drill end-of-game situations. Only with each of the first six games of the series being decided by 10 or more points, the Cavs never had a chance to implement what Lou was teaching. It became a running gag within the team, even causing Irving and Iman Shumpert to razz their coach for spending so much time on something they never got a chance to use. This was their chance, however. One defensive possession stood between Lou's team and the NBA title, and it was playing out right in front of him and the rest of the Cavs bench. It was a mere formality. Curry missed a three, his fourth consecutive miss of the quarter, to finish his night 6 for 19 from the field with 3.4 seconds left. The Warriors got the offensive rebound with 2.2 seconds left, but there was no four-point line for him to try to tie the game. The game was over. The Cavs were champs. The city of Cleveland was a winner, and LeBron James, at long last, had delivered on his promise of a title for his hometown. James was back on the floor, hammering it again with his fist, this time in joy. "Cleveland," he said with tears in his eyes, "this is for you." Epilogue. When he was a kid, LeBron James's favorite sport was football, and there was a time when some who watched him play believed he could have become an all-pro tight end with his size, quickness, and hands. It wasn't meant to be. James gave up football at age 17, despite being an all-state wide receiver as a junior in high school. Yet here he was in an NFL locker room holding a championship trophy. The Oakland Raiders locker room, to be exact. That was where he was about 2 hours after winning his third NBA title, and third time accepting the Bill Russell trophy from the man it was named for as Finals MVP. He'd come there with a bottle of Moet Champagne in his hand and a cigar in his mouth, part of a stash of goods a member of the Cavs front office had secretly been sent to buy in case they needed them for a locker room party. More than $4,000 worth of ski goggles and cigars were sent by owner Dan Gilbert, with orders not to breathe a word of it to general manager David Griffin, who would have seen it as a jinx. James was in the locker room because that's where the NBA had set up a favorite annual tradition of post-game photos with the Larry O'Brien trophy. Every member of the team got to take them for posterity. James wanted three, one with his wife, Savannah, sons LeBron Jr. and Bryce, and infant daughter, Zuri, who had been a special guest with James at his post-game interview session. He wanted one with his mother, Gloria, and one with his three closest friends, business manager Maverick Carter, agent Rich Paul, and right-hand man Randy Mims. As James waited his turn, Richard Jefferson came up to him. After 15 years as a pro, Jefferson had just won his first NBA title and emotionally announced after the game that he'd be retiring. He was later talked out of it and signed a 2-year deal to stay in Cleveland. James ended up re-upping too, signing a 3-year, $100 million contract the following summer. "I have tons of friends that have won championships. I've seen videos from the portrait room. I've seen the pictures. It only made me wonder more if I'd ever get my chance," Jefferson said. "This is everything I've always dreamed it would be. Imagine what it must have been like for LeBron. Making this all happen. The championship, the comeback, the joy, and doing it in the place he grew up." In the moment, Jefferson asked James, "Tell me, was that the most stressful game ever?" "It was close," James said, recalling his 2013 Finals Game 6 victory with the Miami Heat in overtime after Ray Allen made a shot just before the buzzer to save the team's season. Thinking of Miami, James was brought back to something else, something that happened nearly 2 years earlier when he decided to leave the Heat and come to Cleveland to chase the dream he was living at that moment. "When I decided to leave Miami, I'm not going to name any names, I can't do that, But there were some people that I trusted and built relationships with in those 4 years who told me I was making the biggest mistake of my career, James said. And that hurt me. And I know it was an emotional time that they told me that because I was leaving. They just told me it was the biggest mistake I was making in my career. And that right there was my motivation. James hinted at a secret motivation for a long time, but refused to reveal it. Even now he held back, though it was a serious hint he was referring to Heat President Pat Riley, the man who challenged him not to run out the first door when Miami lost in the 2014 finals. I knew what I was doing, James said. I knew what I was doing, and I mean, tonight is a product of it. Just then, Paul walked over to show James his phone. Kyrie Irving was giving his press conference and talking about seeing James's mastery in the deciding game. I watched Beethoven tonight, Paul said, reading Irving's words about James. Irving had delivered too, his partnership with James succeeding under the greatest pressure. As James was weeping with joy and hugging family, Irving found his father, Dredrick, and sister, Asia. As he hugged them, he didn't quite feel a sense of joy at first. I was waiting for more questions about, what about you shooting on this possession, or what about you doing this or that? I was so defensive I didn't celebrate right after we won. I just hugged my dad and my sister. My dad is looking at me like, what's wrong? I'm telling him, I'm waiting for someone to come up and say something to me about what happened during the game. Irving's defiance about his critics didn't last. Soon he was in the locker room and grabbing his phone. He FaceTimed with his hero, Kobe Bryant, who had been texting him and encouraging him during the postseason. All I was thinking in the back of my mind was Mamba mentality, Irving said, using Bryant's nickname to explain his thought process before the game-winning shot. Just Mamba mentality, that's all I was thinking. There was another piece of business for the Cavs once they all got into the locker room, their championship puzzle. They flipped open the case, and as the team stood around screaming, Ty Lue had the honor of putting the 16th piece into place. The final golden niche was in the shape of the state of Ohio. Lue slammed it in with both hands. The room quickly filled with smoke as cigars started smoldering and the champagne started flowing. Security guards tried to stop the smoking. It was against the law to smoke in the building. The Warriors had left the Cleveland visitors' locker room smelling of champagne the year before. The Cavs would leave the Oakland visitors' locker room smelling of smoke. It wasn't the first cigar of the week for Mike Mancias, James's trainer for the previous 10 years. His wife had gone into labor with the couple's first child the day after Game 6. It lasted 26 hours before his son, Malcolm, was born. After they shared their moment with their son, Mancias's wife, Heather, said, Go to Game 7. Mancias had missed the team charter, but boarded another plane, one for Cavs employees, the morning of the game, and made it to the arena in time to put James through his pregame stretching routine. It was his first Father's Day. Gilbert and fellow owners Nate Forbes and Jeff Cohen were walking around with magnum-sized champagne bottles, with each of their names and the team logo engraved on them. They had been a gift when James returned to the team, but the men agreed to save them until they could be used to celebrate a championship. Gilbert bought the team in 2005, and he'd spent more than $850 million in salaries and luxury taxes, built a $25 million practice facility, and fired 5 coaches and 2 general managers to get to this point. He'd earned a celebration. But the post-game party in Oakland was nothing compared to what Gilbert had planned. After the Cavs won Game 6 to even the series, Mark Cashman, the team's equipment and travel manager, started planning what to do if they won. He secretly arranged for a pit stop and kept it quiet. As the team began to pack up and head to the airport down the empty streets late on a joyless Sunday night in the East Bay, the flight crew on their plane filed a new plan, with the destination being Las Vegas's McCarran Airport. Cashman had booked buses to meet them at the private jet terminal and take them to XS Nightclub inside the Wynn Hotel Complex. They landed at 1 a.m. and a short time later walked into the club to see a giant screen congratulating them on their championship. A line of cocktail waitresses wearing James jerseys holding up a sign that read, "We Believed." A custom cake shaped like the Larry O'Brien Trophy, and two giant tubs with 25 bottles of high-end champagne. A lot of time and effort had been put into a party that might never have happened. The Warriors, meanwhile, had to cancel their planned championship celebration for a third and final time. Kevin Love arrived holding a WWE-style championship belt over his shoulder. Matthew Dellavedova was wearing the Tommy Bahama shirt from the Little Kev ad. James was wearing a shirt with RWTW splashed across the front. It stood for Roll with the Winners. After a few hours at the club, the team went to Allegro, an Italian restaurant off the casino, to have some pizza before going to Cleveland, where they'd be met at the airport by around 20,000 fans. It was in this same hotel James had made his final decision to go home to Ohio two summers earlier, beginning a journey that was even more difficult than he could have imagined. He never could have foreseen the battles with David Blatt, the struggles to mesh with Irving, that he'd find a partner in J.R. Smith of all people, that veterans Richard Jefferson and Channing Frye would be inspirations, that a gritty little Aussie named Dellavedova would help along the way, that he'd lead the greatest comeback in finals history with three consecutive hero performances, sealed with the defining play of his career, a blocked shot of all things. Or that he'd be right back at the win, soaking in a championship. It didn't feel like full circle. It felt like the end of the adventure of his life. "It's not even relief, it's just excitement," James said as he closed his eyes and tried to sum up his feelings in the moment. "I'm coming home. I'm coming home with what I said I was going to do." This has been a Hachette Audio production, Return of the King, written by Brian Winhurst and Dave McMenamin, read by Brian Winhurst and Dave McMenamin, directed by Aaron Riley, produced by Audio Media Production, post-production by Audio Media Production. Return of the King is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by Brian Winhurst and Dave McMenamin. Audio production copyright 2017 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.